Welcome to the Pro Politics Podcast. I'm Zach McCrary. I've been working in politics for the better part of two decades, but at heart, I'm a political junkie who wants to talk to interesting people involved in politics. Today, I have a return guest, and I'm doing something a little different. That guest is Rose Kapelczynski, who, among many other accomplishments, managed four successful elections for California Senator Barbara Boxer. I'd encourage you to listen or re-listen to the initial episode with Rose, which came out 2 years ago this month, to get a fuller story of her career. And one of the most important chapters in that career is Rose managing the most recent, very competitive open seat Senate race in California in 1992. With all apologies to now Vice President Harris, who was able to largely clear the field in the 2016 Senate race and was the obvious frontrunner from day one. Going back to 92, Rose managed then Congresswoman Barbara Boxer Senate race at the helm while Boxer won an upset in the primary and then a tough general when California was very much a swing state. And Rose managed each of then Senator Boxer's three reelections and is not working for or on behalf of any of the candidates running for Senate at this point in 2024. Given that we're now in the midst of the first genuinely competitive open Senate seat in California in decades, I thought it'd be worthwhile to talk through this year's Senate race, the candidates, the campaigns, the coalitions, with Rose Kapelczynski, the manager of the last genuinely competitive open seat Senate race more than 30 years ago. Rose Kapelczynski, before we look at this 2024 Senate race, let's take a moment to reflect on the current occupant of the seat, Senator Dianne Feinstein. I had an unfortunate chapter here over the last few years. My words, not yours, not asking you to speak to that. But she's really one of the dominant figures in California politics over the past several decades. I'm no historian, but up there, I would assume with a Pat Brown or a Jerry Brown or a Ronald Reagan, Dianne Feinstein, I'd assume is on the short list of most influential figures in state politics over the past 50, 100 years. Taking a step back from the moment we're in now, can you or how do you characterize her career, her impact, her legacy?
Dianne Feinstein has been a role model for women in politics, especially in California, but even nationwide. She showed strength and tenacity after the horrible murders of Moscone and Milk. At that moment, people saw a woman who could be a leader in the worst possible political situation. Every time a woman politician is tested and meets that challenge, that opens doors in the minds of voters for other women to follow. Feinstein was a very early and accomplished woman when she became mayor, instantly on the national stage. In the 1992 Senate race, we heard over and over again from voters that Dianne Feinstein looked like a senator. Tall, commanding, a powerful charisma when she walked into the room. And as barriers are being broken down, sometimes you need someone who looks the part. And she did, and then survived tough races, had defeats like her painful defeat to Pete Wilson in 1990. Hey, she stood up, brushed off the pieces, and turned around and ran for Senate and won in the next cycle. When Feinstein took on a fight, she went all in. You could see that through her well-known work on the assault weapons ban. We were in a different world, the early 90s, around gun control. It was not a politically popular thing to take on, but she did it and she persevered and she wouldn't budge. And in the end, made a few compromises to get it passed. But her determination was really notable. Similarly, on the California Desert Protection Act, which protected millions of acres of desert lands in Southern California, largely overlooked before then because California has so many beautiful mountains and forests and beaches, which are the glamour public lands issues. But Dianne Feinstein took on the desert bill, fought back off-road vehicle interests, mining interests, anti-government interests out in a set of very red counties. Really a historic achievement that will be lasting for generations to come in California.
That's great context. Before we talk the 24 race, let me talk 1992 a bit with you. You managed Barbara Boxer's successful U.S. Senate race in 92, the seat held for years by Democratic Senator Alan Cranston, a prominent liberal, ran for president in the 80s. He retires ahead of the 92 cycle. It's a pretty wide open field on each side, on the Democratic side, in addition to Congresswoman Boxer, Mel Levine, a congressman from the LA area, Leo McCarthy, the sitting lieutenant governor on the Republican side. The nominee ends up being prominent TV personality from LA, Bruce Hershenson, who gets by moderate Congressman Tom Campbell from the Silicon Valley, as well as future congressman and previous entertainer Sonny Bono. In our previous conversation, you talked in some depth about this race, how Congresswoman Boxer starts as an underdog, wins both the primary and a tough general. Not asking you to break all that down again, and people should go find that conversation in the archives, but what parallels do you see? What's relevant between this 2024 open seat and the 92 open seat 30 plus years ago?
Well, first, I want to say California is a very different state now. So drawing parallels is perilous. If you think back to that time, we had just elected a popular pro-choice Republican governor, Pete Wilson. California was a toss-up race in the presidential contest, a must-win for both sides. And then life and campaigns was much slower. We shared TV ads on VHS tapes. None of our phones were smart. Mark Zuckerberg was 8 years old. It was a very different world. That said, there are some things about campaigns that I think are timeless. Having a sense of optimism about your own campaign and your candidate, a belief that you have a message that is meaningful and resonates, matters to voters. And in the Boxer campaign, we never gave up. We had the House Bank scandal. We had, of course, Rodney King's beating and the civil unrest that followed that. Our team was just really remarkable in that determination. I really believe in the saying, luck takes discipline. To me, what that means is you are ready if luck comes your way. You've prepared the groundwork. You're ready to seize the moment. That's what happened to us when the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings galvanized the country, and particularly women in California. Those things have lessons for the current candidates. This race could change dramatically in the next year. It's far too early to say who's going to win the primary. Will two Democrats advance? Will it be a Democrat and Republican? Those campaigns sticking to their plan, having the discipline to execute on it, will be a significant factor.
Before we dig into the candidates individually, let me ask you a question about political geography, which is to say, why is Northern California so dominant in California politics? It's frankly embarrassing if you're from Southern California, which actually has more population. You do have Senator Alex Padilla from Southern California, who was appointed. So that's, I would suggest, an asterisk there. But looking at almost all of the other Democratic politicians, not just now, but in my lifetime, all of the following are Bay Area-ish politicians: Gavin Newsom, Feinstein, Boxer, Jerry Brown, Kamala Harris, Gray Davis, even going back to the aforementioned Alan Cranston in the previous generation, like former Governor Pat Brown. Why have you had to be from the Bay Area to make it big in California Democratic politics?
I don't think it's a requirement, but there is an advantage. The Bay Area turns out more heavily in primaries. If you look at Bay Area turnout compared to LA County turnout, many, many fewer LA County voters turn out in primaries. And so if your primary base, identification and image is about Southern California, you start at a disadvantage. Why is that? Part of it is density. Much easier, for example, to hold a successful rally in Northern California. People can hop on BART, a bus, or live nearby. In LA, the same rally might require someone to drive for an hour and then spend a half hour looking for parking. It's harder to have that sense of community and political action in spread out Los Angeles than it is in the Bay Area.
There are a lot of variables in turnout, especially primary turnout. And the first election is in March, almost a year to the day from when we're talking now. First round primary in California, a lot of variables that go in to turnout in a primary. Often a primary turnout does not look like the overall registration of the state. But what is the conventional wisdom or some of the rough ballpark expectations, whether it's racial compositions or age composition or partisan compositions? What are some numbers that you suspect the campaigns are penciling in at this early date?
Yeah, one of the dynamics for March of 2024 that will have a huge impact on turnout is the presidential race. We know from past elections that when there's a competitive primary in one party, there is a burst of turnout. So if we are in a scenario where President Biden is running for re-election, but there is a hotly contested Republican presidential primary going into March, Republican turnout will grow. In some past elections, there was a bump of 8 points in Republican turnout in a competitive presidential race. That is a known unknown at this point. We just don't know what the presidential field is going to look like. So it's really too early to do a precise turnout calculation. Typically in California primaries, turnout is around 50%. It can be higher. The Obama presidential primary was 57%. But if you use 50% as a very, very rough rule of thumb, and you assumed that the electorate turned out evenly, which is probably not going to happen in terms of partisanship, you're looking at an electorate that is much older, much whiter, more moderate than the electorate as a whole, and dramatically so than the population. For example, at a 50% turnout, whites are 65% of the voters. 54% of the voters are over 55 years old. So strategists are looking at a very different group of voters to appeal to than the state as a whole.
Well, let's break down the field a little bit. I'll go through the three top-tier announced Democratic candidates. Maybe let's try this. Give me a sense of what you see. Let's just focus on the positives for the moment. What you see as the strengths of each of the three main Democratic candidates, and maybe I'll pull at some of the threads after we give everybody their due here. And I'll just tackle them alphabetically and start with Barbara Lee, longtime congresswoman from the Oakland area. At least pre-squad, she was often considered the most progressive, leftmost member of the House. Give me the case for Barbara Lee as the next senator from California.
They didn't want to hear my voice or anyone who wasn't like them. When my high school said cheerleaders couldn't be black, I took them on. I worked with the NAACP and earned my spot as, guess what? The school's first black cheerleader. When there weren't protections for survivors of domestic violence, I wrote California's first Violence Against Women Act. I didn't quit when I refused to give the president completely unlimited war powers after September 11th and in the face of countless death threats. I was the only no vote. And even though there are no African-American women in the United States Senate, we won't let that stop us either.
Barbara Lee has a proven record being a progressive leader for decades. She has so many stories to tell where she was the lone voice standing up for what's right. And another huge strength for her is that Black women are finally being recognized for their loyalty to the Democratic Party and the argument that California can right the wrong of no Black women in the Senate right now could be very powerful with progressive voters. If you are looking at these three candidates and having a hard time distinguishing them on policy, you're going to look at other things. You're going to look at the ability to make history, make big transformational change, the ability to have someone who's going to be a leader immediately in the Senate.
But with that foundation, let me throw out a possible critique, political critique, campaign critique of Barbara Lee, and I'll do this for the others as well. Will you tell me what you make of it? Big deal, small deal, no deal, however you think about it. I don't know what Barbara Lee's maximum fundraising performance has been to this point, but unlike Schiff or a Porter, I don't believe she's ever demonstrated the ability to raise big money. She's never had to be sure. But that seems like an open question if Congresswoman Lee and or her allies can raise the money it takes to go statewide.
It's yet to be seen whether Barbara Lee can be competitive financially, but I know her team is taking this challenge very seriously, putting together an impressive finance team. It's priority one. A crucial moment for Barbara Lee will be the June 30th FEC finance report. If she shows that she has raised enough to compete, I think then more doors open, more people consider her a viable choice as they're trying to make their voting decision, and more donors dig deeper.
I'm sure all of these three candidates, I presume, will have both campaign operations and at some level, at some scope, support of independent expenditures. Do you think it's accurate that perhaps Barbara Lee will have to have a greater share of the overall pro-Lee spending come from independent expenditures than the other candidates, and maybe we'll be more reliant on that outside independent money?
It's an interesting question. Independent expenditures operate on their own set of rules and dynamics. And one of the dynamics is that money dries up for an independent expenditure committee if the candidate herself is not making it happen financially. Barbara Lee still needs to have a robust finance operation into her own campaign in order to get independent donors to fund a committee. In the end, it might be a more significant part of her spending, but it doesn't take away the need to hit those numbers this year.
And there's also been questions about her age. She's talked about them herself. She's in her mid-70s, Adam Schiff in his early 60s, Katie Porter in her late 40s. Do you think Lee's age, that issue, is something that will be a factor in the race, for the campaigns, ultimately for the voters?
As Jerry Brown, Nancy Pelosi, Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein sat at the top of the political heap in California for so long, there was a growing concern about the need for a generational change. Now there's a different mix. Alex Padilla is in office. Gavin Newsom is governor. Nancy Pelosi probably only has a few more terms in her, but never underestimate Nancy Pelosi, right? There is a generational change going on already. Padilla and Newsom may have taken some of the air out of that balloon. Part of the discussion about age is through the lens of Senator Feinstein, who has had some struggles. If the lens about age is through Nancy Pelosi, it's a very different answer.
Let's move to Katie Porter, the congresswoman from Orange County, best known for grilling corporate bigwigs and House committees. She comes out of the Elizabeth Warren political lineage at some level, I believe. What is the case for Katie Porter to win this race?
We're living through a time of extraordinary change. I'm Katie Porter. Change can be electrifying and exhilarating. But change can also be disruptive and disorienting, like the constant assault on our democracy and the dangerous imbalance in our economy. California needs a warrior in Washington. I use whatever power I have to speak hard truths to the powers that be, to not just challenge the status quo, but call it out, name names, and demand justice. That goes for taking on Wall Street and the big banks, big oil, and big pharma. It's why I refuse to accept corporate power.
Katie Porter has done a great job aligning herself with regular people versus big corporations. That is a very successful alignment in California politics and in the Democratic primary. The image she's crafted, a single mom in a minivan, sends a message to people that I understand your life. As you know, Zach, as a successful influential pollster, there's little more important to voters than feeling that the candidate understands their struggles.
And again, just putting on the hat of being a critic for a moment of Congresswoman Porter, one of the knocks on her could be that she hasn't necessarily been an electoral powerhouse in her own district. She flipped it in 2018, beating an incumbent in a good Democratic year, won re-election in 2020. So far, so good. But last year, in a district Biden won, I'm pretty sure by double digits, she wins by 3 points or so. Should that be a concern for those rooting for her?
Well, she was in a tough district, and no surprise that those voters swing back and forth. That's why they're purple districts. I do think one challenge for Katie Porter relative to Schiff and Lee is her very short tenure in elected office. Schiff and Lee have been in office long enough that they served when people still had a priority to get together and get things done and have a long list of accomplishments that prove that if they went to the Senate, they would be effective leaders for California. Katie Porter certainly demonstrated her leadership abilities grilling those CEOs, but probably doesn't have the same kind of legislative chops the other two do.
That was actually similar to what I was going to pose about her as well in a slightly different way. She ran for office first in 2018, and you've had Barbara Lee, Adam Schiff, building networks in California politics for decades, in thinking about the architecture, the network, the inside game to run for office statewide. Is it possible Katie Porter is just too far behind, two or three decades behind the others building that political network? Is it possible she's too far behind to catch up?
In today's world, when you can build a national fundraising base from your basement, I think Katie Porter has been able to somewhat level the playing field with these more veteran members of Congress. If this was way back in 1992, very difficult to make that leap in just a few years without building those networks statewide.
And the last of the three candidates, again, alphabetically, Adam Schiff, veteran congressman from the LA area, one of the leading Democratic voices on the impeachment and investigations against Trump. What are the assets Adam Schiff is bringing to this race?
I've always believed that what's right matters, that the truth matters, and that decency matters. And when a dangerous demagogue tried to undermine our democracy, I wasn't about to let him.
You can't trust this president to do the right thing, not for one minute, not for one election, not for the sake of our country.
Then I took on the biggest job of my life, impeaching Donald J. Trump.
We have proven Donald Trump guilty. Now do impartial justice and convict him.
After all that, I wish I could say the threat of MAGA extremists is over. It is not. Today's Republican.
One of Adam Schiff's big assets in a campaign context is that he has been thinking about running for Senate for years. He considered running in 2016 when Barbara Boxer retired and Kamala Harris obviously won that seat. He decided not to run. And so if you are thinking ahead, making a career move, member of Congress to statewide in California, 50 times the number of people to reach in a campaign and eventually represent, you are building a donor network, meeting donors around the country, building a small donor network, laying the groundwork for at least financial part of a campaign. Schiff has a huge advantage in financial infrastructure and relationships. Schiff also has an advantage in political relationships around the state. That's why he was able to announce with multiple members of Congress and others supporting him, most notably Nancy Pelosi, but also members like Ted Lieu from Southern California, who's very well known not only in the AAPI community, but as a progressive leader. Same for Eric Swalwell. In the Bay Area, Schiff has had many years to think about this and to build those relationships that are now going to pay off in this cycle.
And one potential hurdle for Schiff, and this borrows some of what you said earlier, is that he's an early 60s straight white guy in a field with two strong women, a field with a groundbreaking Black woman in a very diverse state, lots of voters of color, with many liberal white voters, I'm sure, probably finding it very appealing to vote for a woman and or a candidate of color. Governor Newsom has even said that there happens to be a vacancy, he would appoint a Black woman to this seat. It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but only a little, because it's accurate to say that you have to go back to 1986 to find a Democratic man winning a Senate race in California. Is it possible Schiff just isn't the profile that fits the moment and the mood of this electorate?
Adam Schiff does have a few hurdles to overcome. One is proving that he truly is a progressive leader and would be a progressive leader in the Senate. He has some history with the Blue Dogs. He was positioned as a more moderate candidate and congressman before the days of impeachment.
He actually beat a Republican incumbent back in the late 90s, represented at times a very swing seat.
Yes, suburban LA, more moderate, less ideological voters. And he has to prove that as a older white man, he can effectively fight for diverse California. The electorate in the primary will be whiter than the state as a whole. A supermajority of the voters will be white voters. But he needs to prove, even to white progressive voters, that he is the progressive they can trust to fight for them.
And there's at least one other possible hurdle I can envision for Schiff, but I don't want to jump the gun on this next question. And that is the role of Republican voters. You've already mentioned that it's very possible that Republicans could over-index in turnout in the primary. I'm just pulling numbers out of the air, but could be Republicans represent in the high 30s or low 40s of the electorate in the March primary. And a big difference between 2024 and 1992 is, of course, California's adoption of the top two primary. Everybody's now on the same ballot next March. The top two advance to the November general election, regardless of party. If California had a more conventional primary system, then I'd imagine Republican voters would be largely impotent. Maybe irrelevant is the kinder adjective. But in the California system as it stands today, do you expect Republican voters to play an important role? And at some point for Democratic campaigns to consider appealing to them, either subtly or more explicitly?
Some Republican voters will just take a pass on a race like this. Other Republican voters will vote for anyone with Republican next to their name, even if they've never heard of that person. But there are Republican voters who are those perfect voters who think it's their civic responsibility to show up and make a choice. They could play a small role in this primary. The battle is primarily for Democratic voters and the small number of declined states who participate in primaries.
I really haven't done my homework on the Republican side. Do we have any expectation of if there's likely to be one or two credible Republican candidates? We've seen that in some other times, some gubernatorial races where Republicans have made it to the November general by consolidating a substantial part of the Republican vote. And we've seen other times where the Republican field has been so splintered that no Republican gets more than 7-8%. And you have two Democrats advance to the November general, the 2016 Senate race, the 2018 Senate race, both examples of two Democrats advancing. Is it too early, or do we have some expectations of maybe what is going to happen on the Republican side of the equation?
I think it's too early to tell, but there is a question about whether a Republican who is well-known enough and credible enough will enter this race to pick up the 35% of the vote. That could significantly change the primary outcome. Obviously, a Republican gets into the top two, then the Democrat has essentially won. There is no chance that a Republican will get elected statewide to the Senate in November. I looked back at in the June 2022 primary, Gavin Newsom got 55.9% of the vote. There was a collection of minor Democrats and Republicans that picked up the other percentage of the vote, but that shows that even in this Democratic state, with a popular governor running for re-election, he only picked up 55.9%. Same with Alex Padilla running after his appointment, a Senate candidate for the first time. In the June 2022 primary, he got 54% of the vote against basically unknown candidates.
Thinking about it through its impact on Adam Schiff, Donald Trump took 34% in the 2020 election in California, a blowout loss by any definition. But Adam Schiff is persona non grata to Trump, to a lot of the Trump voters, been vilified by Trump, been vilified in the right-wing media. There's some recent polling indicated that Schiff is both well-known and deeply unpopular with California Republicans, whereas Porter and Lee, much more of a blank slate to Republicans. To be sure, neither Porter nor Lee have any positive standing among Republicans, but neither are Republicans frothing at the mouth against Lee or Porter the way they are against Schiff. And I'm not saying it's the most likely scenario, but could one imagine a situation where Schiff is in a runoff with Lee or Porter and most Republicans breaking against Schiff? And Schiff actually needs not just a majority of Democratic voters to win the race, but I don't know, 60-65% among Democrats to actually get to a majority. That's something the Schiff campaign has to be taking into consideration. Have I just concocted a whole scenario, twisting myself in knots unnecessarily?
One of my rules of campaigns is don't worry about things that are impossible to change. And Adam Schiff cannot change his history on impeachment and the fact that most Republican voters despise him for that. Now, there are those never Trump Republican voters out there, that small group. They might be happy with Adam Schiff, but he can't do anything about it. And as you know, research after the field is set is crucial. We can't predict right now what the forces will be in the runoff campaign. After the primary, there will be much tricky ground for each of the Democrats if it's two Democrats advancing.
The 2018 governor's race came up a little earlier. And in that race, at least part of it, Newsom felt pretty confident he was going to make the runoff and actually amplified, lifted up a Republican candidate because sensibly he thought he would have a much better shot, be virtually unbeatable in a one-on-one race in November against a Republican rather than a one-on-one race in November against a fellow Democrat, Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. My initial instinct is that's difficult for me to envision in the Senate race that any of the three Democratic candidates feel so comfortable that they've already punched their ticket to the runoff that they could and spend resources, time and resources, you know, trying to impact who the other candidate would be. Do you think some of these candidates will look to that Newsom strategy as we get closer to March?
I really don't know. Right now, there's no credible Republican running. In 2018, John Cox had a profile in the Republican Party. He had some of his own money that he could spend and was becoming better known due to that. And then he crucially got Donald Trump's endorsement, which really delivered Republican primary voters for him. And Newsom's efforts helped as well. I don't know who that Republican is this year. Maybe that's a subsequent podcast, Zach, a year from now.
Let's book it. And I guess I probably should have asked this earlier, but what is your comfort level that the field in terms of credible, well-known Democrats is indeed set, that these three candidates are likely to be the dominant players on the Democratic side? Or do you think there's still a substantial chance somebody else jumps in and is a real player?
It's a free country. Anybody can run. But to run in California, you need a lot of money, even at 50%. Turnout in a primary, that's 11 million voters. Only a self-funding candidate or a candidate with a very strong financial base could get in and be credible against these three strong candidates. So I think it's unlikely, but we could see a self-funder get in late. We could see other members of Congress get in. But the longer they wait, the harder it is because donors and voters have started making their choices. Organizations are going to start their endorsement processes. So unlikely to have a late minute surprise, unless it's a self-funder.
Following up on that, and this is an aside and not meant to be critical of the existing field, all three of these candidates we've discussed are top tier candidates in my book and anybody's book. You can look at any of these three and see a future senator. But as I've said ad nauseum, this is the first really up for grabs California seat in 30 plus years. And at this moment, it's a pretty lean field, three individual candidates. Where are the down ballot electeds who've won statewide before? Where are the self-funders? Where are the powerhouse legislative leaders? Where are the big city mayors? Why a relatively small field and one that consists only of members of Congress?
In 2016, when Barbara Boxer retired, I was surprised at how small the Democratic field ended up being because I knew that there were many members of the House and other elected officials who were very interested in serving in the Senate. And with term limits in California, you always need to be looking a couple steps ahead if you're in the legislature in a city position with term limits or holding office statewide. But if you look at the governor's race in 2018, there was a large field. Gavin Newsom, the sitting lieutenant governor, people raised some of the same issues about Newsom as they are about Schiff. Is it time for another white man as governor? We've never had a woman serve as governor. And in the end, he did have strong challenges from Antonio Villaraigosa, former mayor of LA, and the sitting treasurer of the state, John Chung, very accomplished AAPI leader. And Newsom's vision, his positioning as a bold progressive in 2018, when Democratic voters were hungry for that, early years of Trump, prevailed over these other two very accomplished elected officials, both of whom had significant independent expenditure campaigns and endorsements and finance operations. So there's a cautionary tale as you look at California statewide campaigns and how difficult it is to put together the resources, infrastructure to be successful.
In the introduction to this episode, I mentioned, we've talked about it some as well, the 2016 open Senate race to the seat then held by Senator Boxer. We ended up not especially competitive due to the strength that then Attorney General Kamala Harris had in clearing the Democratic field of anyone other than Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez, like Katie Porter, an Orange County Democrat. Congresswoman Sanchez, actually a previous guest on this podcast, and has a great story about her 96 upset beating longtime conservative Republican Bob Dornan. People should go find that episode in the archives. But she was always an underdog in that race. And in the closing stretch, you had big Democratic names, including then President Obama, endorsing Harris down the stretch. That sealed the deal if it wasn't sealed already. And I guess my question is this: can you foresee a scenario where big Democratic names, as they did in 2016, jump into this 2024 race and try to play a referee and endorse a candidate here, meaning a Biden, a Harris, an Obama, a Newsom, a Padilla? Can you see people at that level getting involved in this race and endorsing while the Democratic race is still active?
Well, we've already seen one of the biggest Democratic heavyweights weigh in, Nancy Pelosi, for Adam Schiff, giving him a huge boost as he builds his national donor network. I don't see people getting involved because they think one candidate would be so much better as senator. I think all three of these candidates have proven themselves and have what it takes to be effective in the Senate. So it isn't one of those situations where people think, whoa, we really can't let X win, so let's get in and endorse Y. I don't see that as very likely.
And you mentioned Nancy Pelosi for Adam Schiff. I think just today, or maybe in the last 24 hours, Mayor Karen Bass in LA has endorsed Barbara Lee. Who are the endorsements you think will matter in this race? Elected officials, organizations that are not just of the nice to have variety, but you think could actually move voters?
One of the most powerful brands in Democratic politics in California is Planned Parenthood. Voters trust Planned Parenthood. They see it as both advocacy and under attack, and providing essential health care. So that is a powerful brand. The Democratic Party brand is important. The issue is that, as in most organizations, it requires supermajorities or very strong support of multiple committees in order to win those endorsements. And with three very strong candidates, you could see a lot of those organizations staying neutral. In terms of elected officials, Governor Newsom has to be pretty much at the top of the list. Other statewide electeds will appeal to certain constituencies, will be sought after. And I think most of those endorsements are going to be based on a history of working with the candidate, personal relationships. I mean, what you saw with Pelosi and Schiff, there was no process there. It was inevitable. I think more people will weigh in as this year progresses and the candidates build their campaigns.
You touched on the California Democratic Party, and it's a little unusual compared to many other states where the Democratic Party has a process, often endorses candidates, even in crowded Democratic fields. You've been engaged in this, I know, in numerous times for statewide races all the way down to local legislative races. What are you watching on that front? Is that just inside baseball that doesn't mean much? Is it more important for one candidate than it would be for another? Talk through how you would be thinking about it if you were in some of these candidate shoes.
I think voters are going to be very confused by this choice facing them. Three members of Congress, each with powerful histories and personal profiles, each with powerful endorsements. How do you make your choice? And that's why endorsements can make a difference. Voters look to validators to help them make their decision. If they trust Planned Parenthood and Planned Parenthood has made a choice in this difficult primary, that could be very powerful. The Democratic Party endorsement can help voters choose between candidates that appear pretty similar, and particularly when the candidates aren't well known. However, it's very difficult to get the party endorsement. It requires supermajorities. The delegates to the state convention make the choice. Some of those are appointed by legislators. Some of them run and win in local elections. Others are county party leaders. In this race, at this point, I would anticipate a no endorsement decision because it would just be so difficult for one candidate to get to that supermajority. However, There are many local Democratic clubs around the state. Some are 20 members in a corner of a neighborhood. Others have thousands of members and effective get out the vote operations. From research, we know voters don't distinguish between neighborhood Democratic club endorsement and the LA County Democratic Party endorsement. I would expect a scramble for those local Democratic club endorsements that could give these candidates a little extra edge heading into the primary.
In some states, especially these days, especially a primary, it might be overkill to say that a race is primarily a television race. There might be a lot of import on grassroots style organizing, very targeted mail or digital approaches. It might be line items on a budget you might fill at the same time or even before some big television buys, which can sometimes be inefficient in a primary. Is it fair to say that we should still think of this as a television first, television centric race?
Television is still king. Television is very efficient in a statewide race because everyone you're reaching could vote for you. But digital has an increasing part of candidate budgets because it's so targetable. But it's reaching the point that television reached where we were concerned about mute buttons and people not consuming commercials that we were paying a lot of money to put on. People are swiping right by those digital ads as well. Mail is still a very reliable way to get into the hands of the voters. But if you look at a statewide electorate, possibly 11 million people turning out in the primary, and think of the cost of that mail, you need to come up with some very targeted universes that would be mail responsive. It is an older electorate. Older voters still respond to mail in a stronger way. Field is very difficult. Again, 11 million voters spread out over California, but I wouldn't be surprised to see some limited field campaigns in base areas, or if labor gets engaged. Again, the labor Fed unlikely to get engaged, but individual unions may endorse. And those unions that have effective field operations, you might see some very targeted field.
We talked earlier about the dominance of Northern California politicians, especially on the Democratic side. I don't know how far back you'd have to go. Maybe George Murphy, who was elected in the 60s, to find a Southern California Democrat who was elected to the Senate. And in the 2024 race, you have one Northern California candidate and two Southern California candidates. Why isn't Barbara Lee, given that, if nothing else, the prohibitive favorite in this race?
The power of polarized news media overwhelms geography in this race at this point. Porter and Schiff have spent years creating a profile on MSNBC, on Twitter, and in venues targeted to reach Democratic voters. Plus, they've been part of very high-profile public events like impeachment and high-profile congressional hearings. So they have built visibility through these national media outlets and platforms. Barbara Lee has not. So you see in public polling, Barbara Lee and Ro Khanna polling in single digits. That's what you would expect for a member of Congress in California. And then Schiff and Porter are polling in the 20s. That gap between Lee and Khanna and Schiff and Porter is filled by the national news media, their very successful work to build a profile. One factor to consider when looking at Barbara Lee's viability is that most voters in the state don't know that she's Black. Unlike a Latino candidate where the last name may be a cue to voters, even if they don't otherwise know them. And so her low standing in the polls right now could significantly improve if she can get the message out. She is the only Black candidate on the ballot, would be the only Black woman senator.
Should observers assume that there will be some sort of negative, maybe even if it's only soft negative, is some type of contrast inevitable among the Democratic candidates in paid communication? Is that something that folks should expect to be seeing at some point?
Absolutely. If you look at the 2018 governor's race, there was a lot of work from all the candidates to establish a positive profile, tell their story. But in the end, they had to help voters make that choice between three Democrats who all sounded pretty good. I think you'll see the same thing in this race. Perhaps it will be the independent expenditure campaigns that take on that burden. That's always nice for the candidates if that happens. But otherwise, they may well find that the path to victory requires creating a contrast and defining that for the voters.
Give me a slice of the electorate or a voter subgroup, a demographic or a county, something that if you knew how this given subgroup, this given profile was going to vote either in March or November, that if you knew how that one subgroup was going to perform, who was going to win this subgroup, you'd have a pretty good read on who has the best chance to be the next senator.
That's a very good question, Zach. More suited to a pollster than a non-data nerd like me. You know, there used to be some bellwether counties in the Bay Area south of Silicon Valley, but they have been so invaded by Silicon Valley refugees who can't afford it that San Benito is no longer the bellwether. I would say that women voters are going to be a crucial factor in this race. Do they split their vote between Porter and Lee? Adam Schiff slips through partly through that. Women voters in Democratic primaries are a little bit more reliable at turnout. Many of the more reliable voters are in suburban areas. There are these questions about where voters go. In the governor's race, 100% of Latinos did not vote for Antonio Villaraigosa. And in our multicultural state, we elected a white man for governor again. In California, you can't say that your age or your gender or your ethnicity is destiny as a candidate. Voters are used to voting for candidates who do not look like themselves and accept that.
Let me ask about the impact, the role of Latino voters. This is the first California primary in a while without a credible Latino candidate in 2022. Senator Alex Padilla running for a full term. We've mentioned both Antonio Villaraigosa, Loretta Sanchez in 2018, 2016, respectively. Just glancing at exit polls, which are notoriously bad on racial composition, but the 2020 California exits have Latino voters comprising 31% of the vote, which I suspect is on the high side, perhaps low to mid 20s is a bit more realistic in terms of a presidential election. Whatever the number is, it's a major cache of voters at a time when there's not a credible Latino candidate in the race. I assume that Latino voters are a priority of some order of magnitude for each of these three Democratic campaigns. Is there a reason to think any of these three candidates start with an advantage among Latino voters, or Latino voters are more critical to the electoral math for one of these candidates than the other two? What are you watching from the outside on that dynamic?
Every candidate in this race is trying to map out a path to victory. And that path can be viewed by issues and positioning, viewed through gender, race, geography. Each candidate will be figuring out how to get that number that will guarantee that they end up in the runoff. Latino voters are a substantial and growing vote in California. Political data says they're about 27% of the electorate as a whole. Of course, in a primary, that will be less, probably around 20%, maybe less. Still, with no Latino candidate in the race, that's a substantial block of voters up for grabs, not just in Southern California, but of course in the Central Valley. There's a substantial Latino population also in the Bay Area. I imagine every candidate is looking at where they might be able to get an advantage. If you look at the IGS Berkeley public poll, gratefully for those of us on the outside, publishes all their crosstabs, Porter has an early lead with Latinos. It's 17% to Schiff's 10 to Lee's 7. Small numbers, big margin of error. Hard to say why that is. You can tell us, Zach, about the limitations of polling and numbers like the ones I just used. I could imagine Katie Porter having a special appeal with many Latino voters who are concerned about economy, sending their kids to college and being able to afford that, and her appeal on economic issues as the
single mom in a minivan could have some special appeal. One challenge for all of these candidates is communicating with Latino voters. There's a substantial percentage of Latino voters, even if they are fluent in English, prefer to get their political information in Spanish. Spanish media is an additional cost. It's additional production. You've got to have the right message that's culturally appropriate. Many campaigns make that a lower priority because they're focused on the vast majority of English-speaking voters. But in this race, candidates with more resources, such as Adam Schiff, could have an advantage in appealing to Latinos because they'll be able to afford that Spanish language advertising and mail that can really make a difference with certain populations.
Earlier, you talked about the importance of luck and a lot of the campaigns. The role of campaigns is to put your candidate in position to take advantage of luck, to take advantage of a break. If we stipulate that all three of the Democratic campaigns are going to do a pretty good job on that front, do you feel like there's one or two of these candidates that maybe are more likely to have the ball bounce their way in terms of the political climate, in terms of a national narrative?
It's impossible to predict what national environment or California events will really influence the vote next year. If we go back to the 2020 presidential race for a moment, many pundits at the beginning of that said, oh, Democratic primary voters are hungry to make history. And here we have Black woman, multiple women running, Latino voters are going to want to make history, and that's where their votes are going to go. Other people said, oh no, the economic issues are so central to people's lives. They want bold transformational change, Medicare for all, someone who's going to come in and tear things down and rebuild them in a different way. In the end, the voters decided, you know what? We want the safe, reliable, dependable, tested leadership of Joe Biden. And you could look at this race similarly and say, are voters going to want to put representation at the top of the list and elect Barbara Lee and have that Black woman in the Senate? Do people want someone in the Elizabeth Warren School of Policy in Katie Porter who will hold corporations accountable and put inequality at the top of the list? Or do they want someone who has been tested, proven that in a high profile effort like impeachment, that he could deliver the goods and he has the endorsements to prove it, and vote for Schiff? I could see it going any one of multiple ways.
We're still a year out from the primary, but nobody better to talk about this upcoming competitive Senate race than the manager who helped win the last competitive Senate race, Rose Kapelczynski. Thanks so much for your time today.
Great to be with you, Zach. Always fun to talk politics with one of the country's best pollsters in one of the best firms.
Thanks for listening to the Pro Politics Podcast. Please subscribe so you can access each episode first thing every Tuesday morning. And if you're so inclined, leave a rating and a short review on your podcast app to help more people find this podcast. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook for updates on upcoming guests. Thanks for listening.